wanted to acknowledge that we are in a place. I just learnt this from June, and then I saw it, that we're in a college that supports the Indigenous people in this community. And I wanted to dedicate our evening's practice to them and their generosity in sharing this place with us. And also, being someone who lives in the United States and it being Thanksgiving night tonight, to share my gratitude to the lineage of Indigenous people and their teachings and spiritual practices, and how much they have influenced me in my own spiritual practice. One of my first spiritual teachers was a part Native American Indian pipe carrier. She was part Native American Indian. She was a pipe carrier called Evelyn Eaton, who lived in Lone Pine, but originally she actually came from Canada. And she came to her spiritual practice through something that often is a doorway to spiritual practice, and that is losing everything. She lost her husband. Her husband died unexpectedly. He was an architect, and apparently they had a very lovely house. And she was a housewife, and she still dressed as a housewife. When I met her, she had pearls and a twin set. And she spent a lot of her time creating a beautiful house and searching for beautiful paintings and chairs, and she didn't go into detail. I'm just imagining that part. And soon after her husband dying, the whole house burnt down, and she was totally devastated. And it was out of that devastation that she decided to go back to her her lineage and found a healer and said, "I'd like to train with you." And he said, "It's going to take you 20 years. And it did. She trained for 20 years before she was acknowledged as a pipe carrier. And so from her, I also became a pipe carrier. And I have a pipe hanging on my wall facing the east. And I don't smoke it so much anymore. And there's something about the acknowledgement of that practice in calling into being the earth spirits and the air spirits and the water spirits and the sun spirits and the spirits of great life and the spirits of all the animals and all the plants. That in a way is also the calling of this practice, which is, what is it that supports us coming into relationship with life? Not feeling so bounded or imprisoned in the skin and thinking that life is what's happening inside of this boundary of my skin. Rather feeling the calling of feeling life in a less self-centered way, more connected in all our relations. And feeling that all our relations, and not even in such an abstract way, you know, and sometimes the ways that we find sending metta to all beings is a little easier than sending it to our roommate who hasn't done the dishes again, or our partner who hasn't done their share of whatever it is in the household chores. All my relations, that includes those parts as well, that opening of the heart to life as it is, in its imperfections and in its perfections. And that really is what calls us here this evening, is that yearning of coming home into all our relations, our family's life, and the life inside of what we call myself or ourselves. And so I just wanted to honor that as a beginning, that yearning that we have to come into connection and to come home to this planet, and to give thanks to all the indigenous peoples and their practices that have shown us how to come home. So I was going to talk about right thought today, and so I wanted to begin with the four contemplations that are actually a wonderful practice in terms of right thought. The contemplations of the blessings of being alive. These are four traditional contemplations, the blessings of being alive, contemplating impermanence, contemplating karma, and contemplating the unsatisfactoriness that is inherent in life. And it is said that these four contemplations actually bring us into all our relations, a relationship with all our relations, because they challenge the misunderstandings that we have about our lives, and in challenging that, open the doorway into right understanding, right thinking, and right view. And so beginning with the contemplation of the blessing of coming into this life as a human being. And I think we could acknowledge, probably each one of us easily, the great challenges of being a human being, what it means. In fact, the Buddha said that the best conditions for awakening was not to be born in the Deva realms. And I don't know if any of you have read descriptions about the Deva realms, but it is said that in the Deva realms, you live for thousands and thousands and thousands of years and age very slowly, because things are so easy, that there is delightful music and amazing food and central places to live. I mean, just really fantasy island. And he said that that wasn't a good condition for awakening, because it was so pleasant. And he said, so he was acknowledging that coming into life as a human being wasn't all that pleasant all of the time. And that it was because we experience suffering that we actually are moved to end suffering. But it isn't only that we experience suffering and that we are moved to the ending of suffering. It is that we experience suffering, and each one of us has this capacity, because we're a human being, to end suffering. And that is the incredible blessing of being a human being, is that we have this capacity to end suffering. And I don't know about you, but Have you noticed the times when you've been sitting or when you've been caught in a very kind of negative interaction and something catches you and you're like, oh, right, I'm right here. You know, or I just see that negative thought and energy and I don't have to go there. And isn't that just the purest delight? That capacity to know, to recollect, to be conscious of. It's, you know, in the 60s, in the Beatle era in London where I grew up for some of my life, there was this word brilliant. Like, do you remember? Oh, it's so brilliant. It's so brilliant that we have this capacity to recollect and to know. And it is a beautiful thing to contemplate that you have this capacity. In fact, the Buddha said where was it? I don't have the which sutta it was, but excuse me, there's a story of the Buddha standing by the river Ganges with some practitioners and saying to them, do you see how many grains of sand there are? And everyone nods, and the Buddha says, countable or uncountable? And they say, uncountable. And then the Buddha bends over and picks a pinch of the grains of sand and puts it on his thumbnail, and he sort of shows everyone. It says, do you see how many grains of sand are on my thumbnail? And they say, yes. And he says, this is how few beings are born as human beings compared to the amount of sentient beings who are born into life. And then he gives, but now maybe some of you can remind me too, he gives another simile of a turtle popping her head up from the depths of the ocean once every million years, I think it is, something pretty not often. And on the ocean is a rubber ring. And the chances of this turtle popping her head up and getting it in the rubber ring are how rare it is to be born a human being. Now, sounds pretty fantastic. But just to remember, if you've been practicing this path and realize that so much of what the Buddha says around mindfulness and the practice of mindfulness and non-harming, how true that feels. This might also be true. How radical a blessing it is to be born a human being. And so this is the first contemplation of this incredible gift that each one of us here has inherited. And then not only that, but to see in this amazing inheritance that we each also have been born with a particular bundle of beautiful qualities. Some of us are generous, some of us are patient, some of us are kind, just to name some of them. We each have a particular tapestry of beautiful qualities. And to see that, that's also part of this contemplation of what we've inherited, you know? And to see this blessing or this thanksgiving, the grounds for thanksgiving. So this is what Shanti Deva says, the 8th century Mahayana Indian saint. These human opportunities and faculties are very rare to obtain and easily lost. If one squanders the chance to fulfill the aim of human life, how will such an opportunity arise again? And it's not that often, but in some Mahayana texts, there's a picture of a Buddha holding a flower. And I just imagine him holding this flower and coming and offering it to all of us as human beings and saying, here, you are alive. Take this flower of the Dharma. You have this rare opportunity to awaken. Don't squander it. Not to judge ourselves, because that's the opposite, but rather to see this incredible blessing and gift we have. I know some people aren't into birthdays. I'm rarely into birthdays. My birthday's May the 30th, if any of you care to remember. And one of the reasons that I love birthdays is that I love receiving gifts. This is the ultimate gift, the gift of being the human being and coming into the enormous blessing of receiving the teachings of an awakening practice. And I don't only include the Buddha's teaching in that, but any awakening practice. It could be from Christian traditions, Judaist, Muslim, Wiccan traditions, as well as the Buddha's. The incredible blessing of coming into touch with awakening practices. So, lastly for me, in terms of this talk, acknowledging that even though there are so many people who are born as human beings and have this capacity, they are born into conditions that make it much more difficult to practice. So I was born in South Africa, and living in apartheid, those were conditions that made it more difficult to practice. Or I'm living for a little bit of time in Kenya and going on buses and seeing women, because women are mostly the water carriers, spending one whole day getting on the bus with these big tin drums and traveling to a place where they could get water, and then traveling back on the bus. One whole day just to get water. So conditions that make it difficult, more difficult to practice. We know there are many, many in the world. And I imagine a relay race. And all those people who are alive from all over the world, somehow or another, passing the baton to each one of us here, saying, I can't so easily do this. I'm passing the baton to you because you can. Because that really is what's happening. And each one of us here, because we are here, have received the baton and are in some way saying, I take it, knowing that I practice not just for myself, but for you, because I'm acknowledging this blessing. So, contemplating the incredible blessings that we find ourselves with. And then the next contemplation is the contemplation of impermanence. And we all know that so well. When my teacher Ruth Dennison talks about her training with Ubakin in Burma, she says that he gave instructions every day before he went to work. He was high up in the Ministry of Finance. He was actually the equivalent of the finance minister for some time and other things as well. So high up in the government, as well as running a meditation center in Rangoon. And so he would give instructions every morning. And the instructions were, everyone was meditating in a cell. I don't know if any of you have practiced with Goenka, because in those retreat centers, you have your own little room to practice in. So he would open the door, and he would say, "Anicca, Anicca," and close the door. And those were the instructions for the day. Anicca is the Pali word for impermanence. So impermanence, impermanence, that was the instruction. All things are impermanent. Our life breath especially is just like a bubble on a swift-moving stream. The time of our death is uncertain, and we depart alone from this world. All that is born dies. Even the enlightened masters, saints, sages, and powerful leaders, our longevity and hour of death are uncertain, and then we sally forth alone and unaccompanied. All constructions eventually fall to ruin. All those who are gathered together eventually separate. Everything passes and dissolves, even the mountains and the seas. So resolve now to realize the deathless reality and undying peace of freedom and nirvana. In the Latisvistara Sutra, the Buddha says, "The universe and its inhabitants are as ephemeral as the clouds in the sky. Beings being born and dying are like the spectacular dance or drama show. The duration of our lives is like a flash of lightning or a firefly's brief twinkle. Everything passes like the flowing waters of a steep waterfall." So acknowledging individually and acknowledging as a community something that we know intellectually and often are resistant in our hearts to, that everything comes into being and falls away, including ourselves. I remember reading someone say that truly there was one miracle in life, and that is that none of us think we're going to die. That intellectually we know it, but that really when we finally come to our death, most often we're surprised and we fight it. So acknowledging, just taking a moment and acknowledging that not only do we know we will die, but we don't know when we will die, and we don't know how we will die. It is a big uncertainty. And as Don Juan said in Carlos Castaneda, we can take this reality as a great teaching, because when we carry our death on our left shoulder, it really changes the way we practice. So for example, in general, I feel like my practice has infused much of my life and that there's much more presence and loving kindness, except for when I drive my car. I have no idea what that karma is. It is not easy karma to have inherited, especially living in the Bay Area and driving over the bridge. So 20-minute drives become, 75-minute drives. And one of the things that creates the conditions for my diligence around it is the understanding that when we die according to the Buddha's teachings, the quality of your mind in the moment of your death determines your next reincarnation. or where your consciousness goes. And so I think, if I were to die right now, would I want myself to reincarnate into this mind state? No, I wouldn't. It's a wonderful companion to have in terms of that really what we can describe essentially as a whole practice, which is the abandonment of the unskillful thoughts and storylines and energies and the cultivation of the beautiful ones. That's what we do when we meditate, is abandoning what's unskillful and cultivating what is skillful. And that knowing we're going to die and not knowing when becomes this wonderful condition for abandoning the unskillful. It's just a beautiful practice in cultivating the skillful. And then there is the acknowledgments of the eight vicissitudes of life. There is pleasure and pain, gain and loss, praise and blame, fame and disrepute. And so pleasure and pain, gain and loss, praise and blame, and fame and disrepute. And when I was thinking about it, we had to Google his name because I forgot what his name was. Do you remember Bernie Madoff? From the Ponzi scheme, for those of you who don't remember, Bernie Madoff was someone who worked in stocks and the financial world, stocks and bonds, and making a lot of money. He gave such high returns that he became this like really, really sought after person. And you know, to get to Bernie Madoff was like this very big thing. And, you know, people were banging on the door to get him to take their money because initially he was giving such high returns for people's investments. And he was giving the high returns because he would take people's money and use it to give very high returns to the people who had invested before them, but then he had to take more money to give those kind of returns. And as you know, that crashes. So from someone who was so popular and sought after, now he's in prison. And he took money from the ACLU and from Amnesty International, from the NAACP, and all these, I mean, a lot of really good activist organizations, social justice organizations, schools, synagogues, I mean, all kinds of places. And when people found out, he went from praise and blame to deep disrepute. In fact, his family was so shamed that his son killed himself this year, hung himself. So that's a more extreme example. I can think of different students writing to me and saying, oh, you know, thank you for the teaching. It's so wonderful. Thank you. And then when I wrote the first draft of my book, the editor that I was working with at Random House said, you have to rewrite this book. You know, it's no good. And so, you know, that's life, isn't it? It's like there's just praise and blame. And the kinds of ways that we are attached to one and feel really awful when we hit the other. And this possibility of really contemplating the ways things change all the time, how sometimes we praise and sometimes we're blamed. And I think about, you know, the Buddha, this amazingly awakened being who at some point wasn't listened to by the Sangha. The Sangha got into a big fight, I forget what it was, and he actually left the Sangha and went and sat by himself in the forest for 3 months before emissaries were sent to call him back. So there was the Buddha, deeply listened to for years and then not listened to. praise and blame, praise and blame. You know, the changing conditions of how it is in our life. And then pleasure, pain. I mean, it's amazing how in just one sitting, did you feel it? That amazing change of pleasure and pain and pleasure and pain. So this contemplation of the changing conditions and seeing, not to judge ourselves, but just seeing where we get attached to those things, because it's in the attachment that there's suffering. And I'll just say one more, because I really want to give us time to chat a bit. Story of someone that I knew in South Africa. There were many anti-apartheid activists in jail. My parents were in jail. In fact, most of the activists who were very active were in jail at some point or another in South Africa. Some for a long time, and some just for whatever reason getting out earlier. And there was one man who was actually from Czechoslovakia who happened to be a football player, and he was in solitary confinement for 15 years. And I remember when he got out of jail, and I was a teenager and just sitting and listening to him, and someone said, you know, How did you survive? And he said, you know, it wasn't that different from the training that I did as a football player. And just there was something about that graciousness of, I'm in this condition, so I'll train this way. I'm in that condition, so I'll train that way. That capacity to take learning in that way. And then there's one other incident where I felt so touched. I was driving on the Bay Bridge, stuck in traffic. I put on the radio, and I didn't catch who the man was, but it was someone who had lost his legs. And the interviewer was saying, I hear that you go around and talk to different corporations. And he said, yes. And the interviewer said, and I've heard you say that if you were given the choice, that you wouldn't return to having your legs. And he said, no, I wouldn't. I wouldn't want to return if it meant that I would lose what I've learned by not having legs. And that open-heartedness in inquiring into our lives as a learning experience. You know, and I think I was touched so much by it because I have been very physically active in my life and taken a lot of joy in hiking and kayaking and dancing and doing all these things. And some of you know that I was just talking about it, that actually it started when I was teaching a retreat in Bethlehem. I fell down the stairs, and a piece of my disc chipped off and floated up my spine and lodged against the nerves at L3, L4. And I was in excruciating pain and ended up having surgery. And either the surgery or the chip damaged my nerves. And so I can't do any of those things anymore. And I miss it. It's true. I miss doing those things that I can't do. I can walk, which feels like a miracle, because I was in bed for 9 months altogether. But what I've learned in terms of loving my body and holding through in that whole process of fear, of grief, of I think just the loss, you know, the loss of so much of what I loved in my life. What I needed to find to sustain love in that was something, having found it, that's irreplaceable. You know, and that's the possibility that we are all given, that the challenges that we find in our lives and what we lose, whether it's just aging, I should drop adjust, whether it's aging or whether it's the loss of partnerships or marriages or our children or friendships, whatever it is, that the changes we endure become this deep possibility of connecting with ourselves and coming into relationship with life in new ways that are so precious and beautiful, because the rawness that comes from that loss, the vulnerability, opens our hearts in ways that when we're more in the deva realm, in the entitled realm, you know, we don't have access to so much. So that's enough. So next time I'll come, I'll do the next two. the next two being karma and satisfactoriness. So what do you think? Do you have any thoughts about these two contemplations, or anything I've said, or any disagreements? Yes.
And really, I mean, it seems very simple too. Yeah. You don't have a lot.
Yeah.
Oh. You have so much joy.
Yeah. Yeah. Someone else had that.
Did I hear you say you were from Massachusetts, or you spent time?
Yes.
Did you ever encounter Sita Pamuk Palay Renfrew?
No. No. Who?
Part of my suffering is the attachment to her little book on Buddhism, and I would like to get a copy of it. I'll try to.
She's a Buddhist teacher?
She was a Buddhist. I don't think well known, but.
Lovely. What's her name again?
Sita Amukpane Renfrew.
Renfrew.
The
Great. I'll keep my eyes or ears open to hear about her. Definitely possible. I think when you experience a shortage of water, you know, both in your body and in your life and malnutrition, it's actually harder to practice. So not impossible, but more difficult. Yeah. And also possible. I think think it's ignorance, that we are all born with ignorance and this capacity to awaken, and it's ignorance that blinds us. And the practice is dispelling the mist of ignorance. So that's why. It is the force of ignorance, of not seeing our blessings. And the practice of being present, and the practice of generosity, which is the first practice that the Buddha taught, and the other practices actually begin to dispel that. And so, it's probably true to say for all of you that through your practice, you are more in touch with your blessings. Isn't that true? Does that make sense? You're looking at me quizzically. So in fact, let's just, will you turn to someone you don't know and just take a few moments and talk about your blessings, what you experience as the blessings in your life. I'd like you to get some energy going here. Yeah, introduce yourself. It could be a You can. And when you're ready, would you then both take turns in talking about one change you're experiencing that you would like to cultivate a learning and inquiring relationship to, one change that's happening in your life you would like to open to. Did anything strike you in that sharing?
How small we are.
That's, yeah, that's so true. Yes.
When we send the merit of our practice to other people, how does it work and how does it affect them?
I know that we all have experience walking into a room. Like when I walked into the immigration, the place of, to apply to be a citizen, and I went for my test, I walked into this room, and I thought, this is one of the most negative spaces I've walked into, that we can actually sense the energy in a room. So there you go. There is something living that the nature of consciousness and its expression, whether it's loving or whether it's hating, is actually a felt experience. And so sharing the merit that wishing, that well-wishing, is also a felt experience. And just to quote one of many, many, many experiments, the Harvard Medical Review actually reported an experiment where a group of patients were separated into two groups, and one group of patients, all with the same condition, were prayed for by different denominations, Christian, Presbyterian, Catholic. Those are both Christian, you can tell I'm Jewish, Jews, Muslims, different denominations, Buddhists, and after a number of months, they were tested, and the group who were prayed for were significantly more healed than the group who weren't. Praying is sharing the merit in some way. It's the same thing. It actually, because we're related and we are already connected, that sharing impacts, actually makes a difference. So it's, yeah, thank you for that. So I think we're actually coming to the end of our time together. Let's stand up.
So taking a moment to acknowledge our community, our temporary community, yeah. Appreciating our presence, listening and sharing our practice together, receiving the baton, and sharing again our blessings, our wishes for well-being for all beings tonight. Thank you, everyone, for your practice and your presence here. Thank you.
Thank you.
Evening, and we have two baskets on the table over here for gifts. One is to help cover the costs of this room rental, and also there are extra costs that we're sharing with BCIMS so that Arena could fly to Victoria rather than Vancouver. So it's really lovely that you were able to make that change in your schedule. So could receive Arena's teaching tonight. So just to consider that in whatever you might be able to offer. And to also consider the dedication that Arena has given in her life to helping so many of us in our Dharma journey. She probably doesn't have some great pension plan, and I hope you didn't invest with Bernie Madoff. Yeah.
Did you?